Welcome back to the Mark Steiner Show. I am senior producer Mark Gunnery, and I'm here with Isaac Oliver, writer, performer, and author of Intimacy Idiot, which just came out in paperback. And Isaac, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me.
So you live in New York. What are you doing in Baltimore right now?
That sounded very accusatory. I grew up in Baltimore. I grew up in Catonsville, and my family is still here, and so I love coming back, and I'm back on sort of a mini paperback tour, performing at the Creative Alliance, and did a signing, and now I'm just here to eat crabs and see my parents and sleep and then go back to New York.
How's the tour going?
It's going really well. We were in Chicago recently, where I almost accidentally hit on my second cousin, who I haven't seen in 20 years.
Well, you know, it's a second cousin.
Is that okay?
Yeah.
There's some states where that's okay. Yeah, he came up to the signing table, and I was all emboldened, like one of the few bold moments of my year. And I was opening my mouth to say, well, aren't you handsome? And luckily, he spoke first and said, do you remember me? Oh, my God. Yeah, that would have been bad. So anyway, the tour's going well. Yeah, no, this was the last stop, and now I'm back to New York and back to writing and working on some new things. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
What's your daily life like in New York?
Oh, man. I have a day job still, but I'm trying to become more disciplined as a writer, and so I usually spend most of the day punishing myself for not writing in various forms and seeing what all the internet has to offer in terms of news and porn and GIFs. Mm-hmm. GIFs? GIFs?
You know, it's debatable, but I go with GIFs.
GIFs seems right.
Yeah, because it stands for graphics something.
Right, right.
Not graphics.
Graphic. Yeah. Oh, who knows? Anyway, once I've seen all of those, then I try to write. Mm-hmm. That's my day. It's not thrilling.
Mm-hmm. Do you still work at the theater box office?
I work at the same theater, but I'm in a different department now in like a part-time capacity. I left my box office job last year, actually, when the book came out in hardcover to do my hardcover tour, which was a little more extensive. And then and now I'm back part-time in an admin job, which is nice. It's nice. It's what I am in the mood for right now, like filing and scanning and shredding things. It's very cathartic. I just pretend the feds are coming all day and just shred documents for a nonprofit theater, so it's not that. The feds aren't actually coming. Oh, Lord.
Well, what's your relationship with theater like nowadays?
I mean, it's as an audience member. I mean, I went to school for playwriting, and I really would love to write another play at some point. I mean, I didn't necessarily set out to write about myself primarily, but I enjoy it. I mean, I enjoy, you know, comedic essays and personal essays. But, you know, I'm looking forward to writing about other people again.
Tell us about your book. Mark Steiner interviewed you a few months ago when the hardcover came out, but some of our listeners might not know. What is Intimacy Idiot all about?
It's a book of humor pieces and personal essays that are all about my sort of awkward, sweaty, slutty life and just trying to find, I don't know. It feels like a sort of chronicling of a coming of age, I think. It sort of follows me through my mid to late 20s and sort of trying to navigate urban young gay life with, you know, all the apps and the technology and the things that make it easier for us to connect but also harder to connect. And also there are lots of sort of ridiculous stories from my box office job and, you know, the little intimate moments that I was privy to with customers and moments I witnessed on the subway. So it's a real sort of collage of pieces that hopefully paint, you know, a sort of overall arc of a city and a time and me, ultimately.
So you write a lot about online dating and hookups. How do you think that the technology that exists today is affecting our sex lives and personal lives?
Well, I mean, I think in a way it's interesting. I mean, I don't know if it's the same way here, but I imagine it is. I mean, I go to gay bars in New York and everybody's on their phones. Mm-hmm. You know, everybody's on Grindr in the bar, which is so meta in a way. You know, it's
Will you explain how Grindr works?
Oh, God. Well, as their artist in residence, I'm happy to describe. No, I mean, it's a location-based app. Mm-hmm. Where it's somewhat similar to Tinder, but it's where people have profiles that you can either engage, you know, sort of send them a chat message or not. But it's all based on location. So you can, and it tells you how far away you are from these people, and it shows you a picture of them, and you can start chatting with them. Mm-hmm. And it serves a variety of purposes. I think it started out more as a mainly for sex app, and now there are all sorts of people on there looking for all sorts of things. Mm-hmm. I just went to a Grindr wedding of two dear friends. I mean, it was they met on Grindr. That was to the extent that the wedding was Grindr themed. But, you know, it has all sorts of results. Mm-hmm. But, I mean, in a way, it's not that it's eradicating the need for gay bars, but it is sort of taking the reins of what gay bars used to be. You know, I mean, and I think it has sort of a, and I don't mean this to sound as dramatic as it is going to sound, but it has a slightly re-closeting effect, I think, in that, you know, gay people used to have to go out and be physically among each other to be gay. And now there's something about we're all in our apartments, mm-hmm, alone in the dark at night on these apps. And I don't know. There's a distance.
But then the flip side of that, which is interesting, is that you can be out in public and see who around you, mm-hmm, is on there.
Yeah.
And yeah. I had
a guy on the street point at me and go, Grindr.
What? How did that make you feel?
I felt like I was Hester Prynne. Like, what? It was very intense. Mm-hmm. Anyway, but so yes, I mean, it doesn't fully closet us, but it's interesting. You know, this isn't necessarily a fully formed thought, but you know, for as easy as it makes it for us to meet up, you know, and also we're spending less time together, mm-hmm, in the process. So it's interesting. But I don't know. I got, mm-hmm, a book out of it.
Yeah.
It works. You meet people.
Do you want to read something from the book?
Oh, my goodness. Sure. This is a piece called The Dark Place. No matter where you are, you're never far from the dark place. It's a late-night malaise. Portals include bars, family reunions, odd-numbered seating arrangements where you're at the end of the table like an extremity, jokes you missed the beginning of, sing-alongs, and playbill.com. Like catching the train to Hogwarts from platform 9 3/4, you too are whisked away into a magical world unseen by the general public. Through the train window, you can see the bridge you just crossed blow up and crumble into the river below. In the Dark Place Welcome Center, Bonnie Raitt and Morrissey, the poet laureates, sing from Bose speakers tastefully hidden in planters and behind rocks. Help yourself to the complimentary rose-tinted glasses in the bins by the exits. There are weeping willows to sit under. The cafe menu boasts warm humble pie and local foot-in-mouth. Then the thoughts arrive. You don't have as much of a way with children as you think you do. You don't have as much of a way with adults as you think you do. Everyone at this party could take you or leave you. Your mouth is less of a sex organ and more of a veterans hospital. Everything ends. You have a fupa. In terms of how to find your way out of the dark place, here's the route I've found most successful. Go home, sit on your couch, and watch one episode of Roseanne. Go to sleep. You'll feel better in the morning. And if you don't, they made 8 seasons of Roseanne. Well, 9, although I don't count that bat crazy last one.
Yeah, what happened in that last season?
I cannot tell you.
She got money. She won the lottery. Yeah. Someone died or something.
Dan's dead.
Dan was dead.
Spoiler alert. Dan has been dead all, like, he had a heart attack in an earlier season and recovered. Uh-huh. And then the final episode reveals that, like, he actually did die. And this has all been a dream that she's had. I mean, what a way, like, I don't know. Roseanne is also voting for Trump, so what do I know?
I know, but, and like 4 years ago, she was a nominee for the Green Party.
It's so bizarre.
Very bizarre.
But I just, I mean, that show was so brilliant and so melancholy and so real that to then give them money in the end was the strangest way to wrap it all up. Anyway. I could talk about Roseanne for hours.
Okay, but Roseanne is great. I mean, what other TV, movies, theater, books like were affecting you as a young person?
Like
the time when Roseanne was on.
Oh well, I mean, The Sound of Music was huge. Mm-hmm. Anything with Julie Andrews, Bette Midler. I'm trying to think. You know. Sex and the City, Felicity, Dawson's Creek. I mean, those are all formative.
Yeah.
Very formative. Which is why I walk around New York pretending I'm Felicity.
Okay, Sex and the City. So for all those that show's limitations and problems.
How dare you? The movies are garbage. I'll give you that.
Okay. Well, it did present a complex panorama of sexual experiences and desires, and albeit from mostly rich, straight, white women.
Sure.
It presented a complicated but funny picture of female sexuality that was really groundbreaking at the time. Mm-hmm. And I'm wondering if Sex and the City affected your writing at all.
Oh, hugely. Hugely. I mean, I think everyone, not just women, were liberated by that show. I mean, there were the freedom with which they spoke about sex, the sort of candor and the humor and the surprising and beguiling ways that they talked about sex were hugely inspiring and just delightful. I mean, that's why that show. I actually think. I mean, there are a lot of people, like Emily Nussbaum just wrote that thing in The New Yorker about how this, you know, everyone calls The Sopranos like the thing that, you know, such a, you know, benchmark. And she argues for Sex and the City being like right up there with The Sopranos, you know, changing television. And I completely agree. I mean, I think, you know, there's a frankness, but also there were moments of true crassness or, you know, cringing, eye rolling, like, oh God, on that show. But for the most part, I mean, the sex was presented, you know, not to be titillating, but for either comedic effect or emotional effect. And that's something that I also try to do in my work. I mean, this book is very explicit and sexually frank, but I don't think it's shocking, you know. I don't know. Sex is an equalizer. It's something that we all have to get naked for, you know, and we're all kind of on a level playing field when we do it. And it makes people really vulnerable. And so I think when people are telling stories about it, there are so many entry points. That's emotionally for people, you know, it's very relatable to talk about sex, and that's something that I've certainly found in sharing my own stories about it, is that everybody has stories and ways of connecting about sex, because it's rarely great.
Yeah.
You know, it's more often awkward and strange. So, well, and funny.
Well, furries don't have to get naked for it.
How dare you?
This is something I liked in your book because you had this story in here about going home with a furry.
I didn't know he was a furry at the time. Yeah, we met on Grindr. He was an Australian flight attendant. He lived in Dubai and he was in town just for another night. And he came over and we had, by all accounts, a human night together. Mm-hmm. And then just sort of in the afterglow, we were talking and he revealed that he was a furry. And it was just the strangest, funniest, sweetest night because he was so wholly himself. I mean, he really was. And I think that's something when you are sharing an intimate moment with a stranger, you can be completely honest. Mm-hmm. And I felt like he was showing me who he really was, and I found that charming.
And I thought that was really tender because I feel like the story in different hands could have gone towards a sort of like titillating, kind of exploitative of like, oh, look at this freak. And I think that you have this respect for the varieties of human experience and sexual desires that I think is really, really nice to be seeing in comedy writing as well as gay literature right now.
Yeah. I mean, I think, I don't know. I mean, I'm not out to really make fun of people unless they bring food from home on a plane, which Mark told me he did, and I'm still horrified. But I reserve the highest level of scrutiny for myself. And, you know, I for me, comedy is a positive thing. For me, you know, I think humor is something that helps me through most, if not all, situations. And I find it to be community building. I mean, there's something about, you know, so many of the pieces in this book were written, you know, in moments of isolation or, you know, melancholy or depression. And it has been the loveliest thing to then go out and be reading these stories in front of people and hear people laughing and they're laughing with me and maybe at me a little too, but that's okay. But you know, it's a balm. You know, it has a healing and restorative effect. So I'm not necessarily interested in the sort of destructive elements of comedy. Mm-hmm.
And there's a tradition in LGBTQ communities to use comedy and theater and performance to comment on the world and critique the world and in a kind of serious manner. And do you think that you are doing that in your work?
I mean, I hope so. I mean, I think gay people have the best senses of humor. I mean, because you have to. Because I mean, I think there has to be so much pain in humor. I mean, I think in order, you know, in order to be funny, someone had to have not wanted to sleep with you at some point in your life. You know, like it, like you have to have been rejected, have lost things, have been kicked around. You know, I think there's a sort of darkness that's essential to having a sense of humor, and I think gay people have that. I think it's one of our most exciting attributes, actually, and this sort of optimistic but very, you know, sharp humor and using that as a lens for the world. I mean, I don't necessarily consider myself qualified to necessarily be writing about all the current events and things like that. You know, I'm not educated enough in that sense, but I do like responding to the world around me and the people around me, and it helps me engage.
So what are you reading right now, and what are you listening to, and what are you watching?
I'm reading Nora Ephron. I'm reading her early journalism pieces, the Scribble Scrabble and Wallflower at the Orgy collections, because I love her and she's one of my all-time favorites and I just think she's incredible and what a loss. And what else am I reading? I just started The Goldfinch, and I also have A Little Life. I have this pile of just 800-page books, you know, that all came out recently. And I'm a terrible gay person for not having read A Little Life yet, but I just don't feel like crying for months.
Yeah.
Which is what everybody does.
It's, I was listening to it on, on Audible, and I just, like, stopped.
Who reads it? Does the author read it?
No. Somebody else does.
Yeah.
It's good. It's a good performance of it, but it is a true bummer.
Oh, God. Sometimes what an endorsement.
It's similar with I just started reading Jonathan Safran Foer's new book, which is coming out in the beginning of September.
Is it a novel?
It's a novel. It's his first novel in, 11, 12 years or something. It's epic. It's about 550 pages long.
Jesus.
And I read it when I had jury duty. I read about the first fifth of it, and then I got home and I put it down. I'm just like, this is so depressing.
Yeah.
This is like, it's hard to read something just like so depressing. And, you know, something that's nice about Jonathan Safran Foer is that there's a level of like humor throughout.
Sure.
But yeah, just for myself lately, I've had a lot of trouble. Like, you know, for my job, I'm reading so much depressing stuff about what is happening in the world right now. And then when
I open up
a book, and it's just like, you know, the way novels can be even more heavy because they really get into the emotional undercurrents between how we act as people to each other. So it can be really like emotionally disruptive for me to read like depressing novels.
Well, especially, I mean, it's interesting how, especially right now in our current climate where this has been such a rough year and it just, you know, it feels like we can barely catch our breath between all these horrible things that are happening. And I don't know, it sort of makes you understand the appeal of like Hollywood being escapism that. So it makes me want to go see Ghostbusters and AbFab, and like those are the things I kind of want to see right now.
Yeah.
So I don't know. I mean, there's a lot. It's depressing. So I'm trying. Yeah, I'm watching The Good Wife. Uh-huh. I'm almost through that. I just had my appendix taken out a month ago, so I had a long stretch where I just watched that.
Yeah.
And so much I almost turned into a BlackBerry, which was quite possible with oxycodone.
Mm-hmm.
I was a great BlackBerry. Sorry, I've taken us off the rails.
It's okay. Yeah. Okay, well, what do you have coming up next for your writing? What are you working on?
I'm in residence at Joe's Pub in New York this year at the Public Theater. And so I'm doing every month, every 6 weeks or so, I do a night of material there. And, you know, it's about half of it is material from the book. And then I really am trying to write, you know, new things and work on new pieces. And I'm trying to put myself in, you know, new scenarios and see what happens. I went and spent a day on a gay porn set in New York and in an Airbnb. And, I'm trying to, like I was saying to you before, you know, really just be like a sponge right now. Just read and watch and listen and meet people and see what happens. I mean, I'm still, you know, plugging away at Intimacy Idiot. I'm working on a TV adaptation of that, and which I want to write and be in. Just putting that out there.
Do you want to play yourself?
I would like to play myself, actually. I mean, it's not a, you know, it feels right. Mm-hmm. That's my instinct. I think it should be someone non-camera ready.
Oh.
Which makes it a tough sell, I understand, but my poor agents are there. They're supportive.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't know. I'm sort of in between things now, which is I'm trying to remind myself that it's an exciting place to be, even though it feels scary. But yeah.
And you said you're trying to write about other people more. What's What feels different about writing about other people than writing about yourself?
Well, there's a well, you know, within yourself, and I feel a little depleted at the moment. You know, I think I don't find myself to be an endlessly fascinating person. Just because, you know, I spend all my time with myself, yeah. And, you know, I mean, I think I'm good company. But I don't know. There's something about, you know, another person where they're just, you know, you don't know them. You don't know everything about them. And I like that mystery. I mean, I'm speaking more, I guess, about writing something fictional again, you know, either a play or a screenplay or something where I can have a little more fun with the other characters. And I mean, that being said, I mean, the book, I feel strongly the book is not solipsistic. I mean, I actually think the book is actually about other people, you know, and you sort of learn about me through my encounters with these other people. But, you know, I really am trying to capture, you know, even just a glimmer of these people. So it's not just a portrait of me. It's not a self-portrait. It's a group shot.
Well, I've been talking to Isaac Oliver, writer, performer, author of Intimacy Idiot, which just came out in paperback.
Yes.
Isaac, thank you so much for coming in.
Thank you so much for having me, Mark. It's so good to see you.
The Mark Steiner Show is brought to you by MeQ, Baltimore's credit union. Offering a full range of financial services, MeQ, Baltimore's credit union, is helping its members and its community prosper. When you invest in yourself, MeQ invests in you. More information, www.mecu.com. He touched the kinks and sinks into the sounds. She frequents the fatter joints called underground. Our funk zooms like you hit the Mary Jane. They flock to booms, man, boogie had to change. Who freaks the clips with mad amount percussion? Where kinky hair goes to unthought of dimensions? Why is it so fly? Cause hip-hop kept some drama. When butterfly rock the light blue suede pumas. What about a cut? We push it off the corner. How was the buzz entire hip-hop era? Was fresh and fact since they started saying Audi? Cause funk's made fat from right beneath my hood. The Cuba of the styles like Miles-ish. Like 60s funky worms with waves and perms. Just sending junky rhythms right down your block. We beat to rap, what key beat to lock, but I'm cool like that, 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 I'm cool like that. I'm cool like that.